Thank you. And so thank you all for coming. I see we have a wide audience here, at least one professor, a few graduate students, and an instructor, and I think it's still a majority undergraduate students, however. My apologies to all the pure math folks in the audience. I'm going to be sloppy. But other than that, you know, I'd be talking about some things which can be made mathematically, even though I won't do it that way. So I'll be talking about a connection between games and mathematics or complexity theory. And this is a subject that can be viewed from a lot of angles. You may be familiar with the use of games for modeling things like economics or whatever. So those of you who've seen A Beautiful Mind, John Nash was one of the people who got the theory of games and going in economics. And so for that reason, a lot of people study strategies for games. When do games have good strategies and what are the good strategies? Well, I'm not going to talk too much about strategies for games here. Also, games have been used a lot in mathematics to sort of model certain situations. In fact, the philosopher Hintikka has argued that, in fact, we should define mathematical truth in terms of games. You have one person who says it's one to prove it true, another person who doesn't, and whichever, depending on which one of them can win the game, should be how we define what truth is. Now, I think most mathematicians will disagree with that point of view, but at any rate, it's not completely far out. However, I'm not going to worry about that either. The notion of games has come up a lot in terms of complexity theory, trying to understand how hard computations are, just sort of a way of thinking about things. For example, databases are accessed by queries, and depending on your query language, you may or may not be able to express something, and depending on what kind of query language you have, it may or may not be possible for the database program to answer your query quickly. And so, in terms of thinking about things like that, then sort of games, sort of playing a game with the database engine. And so you sort of think about the game and what kind of strategies could exist. And that gives you a way of thinking and arguing about the capabilities. Now, most of the games there were invented just because they model the database or whatever system very well. And it's not a game that you would think of people actually playing. What I'm going to talk about is the games I'll be talking about are mostly ones that people actually play. So, for example, one of them is chess, and I'll be talking about checkers and Go. Go is one of my favorite games to actually play, but it's interesting in complexity theory as well. But I'll be talking about them as cases where we can interpret computation as a play of that game. So in fact, if we wish, we can define chess positions that model arbitrary computations. And then the difficulty of understanding a chess position and who's ahead or can white force a win or whatever becomes a way of understanding that computation. And so that's then the difficulty of playing chess perfectly is actually the same as the difficulty of doing computations. Now, that part I'm not going to explain a lot. What I'm going to do, though, is sort of go look in at sort of computation and how we can treat it as a game, and the kind of thought that would go into saying like a game like chess or whatever could be a model there. And in particular, I'll give you some sort of insight into why some of these games seem to be very difficult for a computer to deal with. Okay, so here's a sort of brief outline. I'll give you a sense of what I mean by game, and then I'll switch to talking about computations, and in particular, why some computations are just very difficult. And then I'll reinterpret computations as being games, and then, depending on how much time I have at the end, I'll say more or less about some of these natural games that people have been playing for centuries, or maybe just years, and how they can be these games which illustrate computations. So I probably have too many transparencies here to get through them all. So if any of you want to break in at any time and say, I didn't understand that, the worst thing that can happen is I won't get through as many slides. So please feel free. Right. This first game is one that's been investigated a lot in terms of playing strategies. This game is called NIM. And as always, we'll think of a game as being characterized by the possible positions of the game and then the moves that each player might make from a given position. And in the game of NIM, a position is simply a set of non-negative numbers, a non-empty set for the pure mathematicians. And then a move consists of selecting one of the numbers and decreasing it by an arbitrary amount, but except not below zero. Everything is a non-negative integer here. And then, by definition, the game ends when all of the numbers become zero, and the person whose turn it would be to move next loses because they can't do anything. All the number has been reduced as far as it goes. So here's a very brief example of a game. My set here has size 2, so we start with the numbers 5 and 2 as the position. The players are Alex and Beth, and Alex decides to subtract 3 from the first number, so now both numbers are 2, and then Beth decides to take 1 from the first number, and so now the values are 1 and 2. Alex takes 1 from the second, 1 and 1, and Beth takes 1, Alex takes 1, and now both numbers are 0, so it's Beth's turn, so she loses, and Alex wins. Now, with two numbers, it's fairly easy to see that when both of the numbers are equal, then the person who does not have to play from that position can actually guarantee to win by simply keeping the numbers equal all the way down, and eventually they hit 0. Now, Alex seems to have known that fact because... because, in fact, his first move was to make the numbers equal, and then he kept them equal just by matching Beth's moves. Now, when you have more numbers than just the two, then it's a little bit more difficult to analyze, but it's certainly possible to do that analysis. And if you know the rule, then you can examine a position and see whether or not, see which player has the advantage, and if it's your turn to move, whether or not, which move you should make to maintain an advantage if you have one. Okay, so this is one game, and it's a fairly easy game. Not entirely trivial, but interesting. Another game, which you're probably familiar with, is that of checkers. So you just have checkers on your board as a position, and the moves are, the diagonal, moving them diagonals, and of course you get the jumping rules, which I won't bother to explain here. Just move. If you don't know checkers, you move the pieces around. If you do know checkers, then I don't have to explain it. And the end of the game is, again, when a player who cannot move loses. Now, if you're actually playing checkers, this usually happens because, in fact, you've lost all of your pieces, and there's none of them you can move. Here's a situation where, in fact, if, say, white makes this move from here to here, then black actually has no movement left, even though he has a piece. So that would, again, be a loss for the black player. Now, this game of checkers is actually fairly difficult. It's not just a kids and grandfather's game. It's actually pretty difficult. You may be familiar with the checkers program Chinook, which actually plays a computer program which can play checkers better than any person, certainly better than any person now alive, probably better than any person who's ever lived. And so you say, well, why am I calling this such a difficult game? Well, I'm really thinking about games here as being arbitrarily large objects. So in the case of checkers, I'm not going to restrict it to be an 8x8 board. I'll allow a board, well, let's keep it square, it wouldn't have to be square, so it might be 20x20 or 1,000x1,000, and there might be a whole bunch of pieces there. And so obviously the game has gotten more complex. And Chinook does very well at playing checkers because it actually has a list of all possible positions with only a small number of pieces. this here? Can you have enough volume from here? Yeah, okay, good. I think maybe I can avoid knocking you off. And if I put this in my pocket, that still works. You're still getting a good signal? Yeah, okay, good. Yeah, so Chinook has a list of all possible positions with only a small number of pieces for an 8x8 board. If you go up to a larger board, there's a lot more positions that it would have to store. And second, the amount of time it would take to get from a position with a whole bunch of pieces down to the small positions is much larger. So this much larger database it would need is actually much less useful. So Chinook is taking advantage of the fact that a checkers board is actually fairly small. If you make the board larger, things get very complicated. Now, it may be that Chinook could still beat the ghost of Martin Tinsdale even on a 20x20 board, but it would not be playing perfectly. Okay. So why is checkers a hard game? Well, one thing you can say is that there's a whole bunch of positions. If we have n squares, say n equals 64, and then each piece could be blank, it could be empty, black, or red, and so that would give you 3 to the n over 2 positions. Or if you remember, checkers, we have kings, so there's 5 different states that a cell could be in. That would give you 5 to the n over 2. So, but of course, some positions are unreachable, so you don't quite get that many. But anyway, you have this very large number of positions possible, and you can't go through all of those and examine them. You just don't have time. Particularly if n is larger than 64. I mean, even n equals 64, you're in trouble. You can't look at them all. So that's one explanation for why it's difficult. But it's not a good enough explanation. If we contrast with the game of NIM, if you have a game of approximately the same size, let's say about n bits to represent it, so k numbers of n over k bits each, then that's 2 to the n positions, roughly the same number. And yet NIM is easy, because we have these rules for what's good and what's not. So simply the number of positions is not a good measure of the complexity. Certainly if there's only a few positions, we would have low complexity, it would be easy to analyze by an exhaustive search. But if there's many positions, that doesn't tell us whether or not there's a rule by which we can examine these positions and determine who can win from them. Okay, so that's my introduction about games. The basic thing is that games are defined in terms of their positions and who can move, and then who eventually wins the game. And we're thinking about about perfect strategies, so that you want to play if you're playing against God or something like that, a nice God who doesn't actually cheat and change the universe on you. Anyway, so that's sort of the introduction to games. Now, I want to talk about difficult problems to compute. This is the main subject of computational complexity, how complex is a given problem. And I've listed here some more or less well-known examples of difficult problems or impossible ones. So I think we have it in all of our first-year CS courses. If you want to sort numbers using comparisons, then you can't do it in a linear number of comparisons. If you take finite automata as your model of computation, you can't do things like matching nested parentheses. But these are for restricted models. If you get rid of comparisons as exclusive operation, or you go to something that's much more reasonable than a finite automaton, then these things are just trivial. Well, not trivial. You can actually sort faster than n log n as long as you don't restrict yourself to computation, to comparisons. But at any rate, for problems that are completely unsolvable, I'll give the example of the halting problem. Given a program and an input, is the program actually going to halt on that input? And this is unsolvable. You can't solve it in any amount of time, no matter how much. So I was just telling my CS360 students about that just now in the course. So, Joe, I hope that was understandable. They can trust you that it's true?
It's true.
Okay, good. I've also given an example here of a problem which is theoretically solvable, but I guarantee you there's no way to solve it in any reasonable amount of time. And that is, if you're given a multiprocessor system and you want to know whether it's possible for that system to deadlock, and each processor waiting on some another, then that problem is, depending on exactly how you define it, anywhere from impossibly difficult to compute to undecidable. But that's a really hard problem. But at any rate, so here we have these things about computations. Each of these has its own method of proof. But where's the games? Okay. I'll actually talk about games which are derived from computations. And depending on how the time goes, I may get to all three of these kinds. There's a game that I'll call the long game, in which the length of the game, the number of moves in the game, is approximately the runtime of the program, the number of steps it actually executes. In some circumstances, we can do a different kind of game, which actually runs shorter. So it's actually the play of the game actually lasts for time that's only logarithmic in the running time of the program. But this is only applicable if the program uses a small amount of memory. And then finally, I'll get to some of the games, which actually turn out to be some of the best-known games in computational complexity, which are the solitaire games, where one person is just watching to make the other person make sure the other person actually obeys the rules. And so only one player has to have any complicated strategy. Okay, so as a first step towards defining these games, I want to remind you, hopefully it's reminding for everyone, about those programs that we call interpreters and compilers. So an interpreter is simply a program which, when given a program and an input for the program it's given, will actually run the program on that input and tell you what the result is. So, for example, scripting languages often do that kind of thing. So, for example, a Python interpreter or Tickle or whatever are doing that kind of thing. Now, perhaps more common, if you're using Java or C or whatever, is you have a compiler which does part of the job of an interpreter. It actually takes the program, but not the input, massages the program, and turns it into something that the machine can actually run, and then once it gets the input, it goes and does it. Now, compilers in particular will do some kind of optimization. And in the modern days of RISC processors, this optimization can get very complicated. But basically, it has a bunch of things that tend to make instructions execute more quickly than they would otherwise, either by sometimes changing the order of them or moving instructions for sort of a different place in the code, or making sure that stuff that you need to access frequently actually sits in the registers where you can get it frequently rather than having it be on the disk and have to get it out there every time. So, but these are just tweaks to make individual instructions work faster. And compilers sometimes do very well at that. Sometimes they don't do so well. But at any rate, they're always at the level of individual instructions. They might move them around or substitute one instruction for another, but they're really doing the same computation. The question is simply to do each step faster. But suppose there were a way to do something really clever and to take this list of instructions and say, nah, I don't want to do that. I'm going to do this completely different thing over here. And I guarantee I'm going to get the same result, so you'll be happy, and it'll run in fewer instructions. Now, I'd not say, you know, we'll just make bigger instructions, massive instructions that can multiply 10 by 10 matrices in one instruction. No, that's not what I mean. I mean the same kind of instructions being executed, but you may run the computation a completely different way and get by with fewer. That would be a pretty smart compiler. Well, in fact, in general, you can't do that. Some programs you can say, gosh, this is a really stupid algorithm. You know, it does this thing is doing insertion sort. Let me substitute quick sort for it. Well, you can do that in some cases. But in general, you can't not always do that. But I mean, that is the kind of transformation, going from, say, insertion sort to quick sort or merge sort or whatever, is the kind of transformation I might be thinking about when we're doing this super optimization. It's much more than just executing individual instructions faster. So here's a problem. It's basically a specification of a problem that this supercompiler might have. So that this So let's let t be a function that's measuring our time. So t could be n squared or whatever. And the following task for a program that we're going to write or thinking about writing. So we're given a program p and an input I, and we want to interpret that program p on I and determine the result. However, we're only required to return the right result if, in fact, the program p with the input I runs for a number of steps which is bounded by the function t. So for any time-bound t, say quadratic, I would want to get a interpreter that could improve any quadratic time program. Now, what it did to a program that actually didn't run in quadratic time is completely open. You know, it could run forever if it wanted to. But we want to find the output of program p on I if indeed p actually runs fairly quickly on I. And what we want for our optimizer is a program that can go through and interpret this program, except do something else, and produce the same answer in less time, fewer number of steps. And this is what we like to exist. Now, can this really exist? Well, a partial question of that is, if someone hands you a program and claims that this is such a program, could you actually determine whether they were correct? Well, in the modern day and age, we are all receiving things just handed to us that make claims about what they do. So suppose one day someone presents you with this. Here's that super program. It'll take any code off your program and just zip it through fast. Run it twice as fast. You, of course, you're all in computer science. Well, not all in computer science. But all of you have great virus checkers. So you can afford to download the program, and your virus checker says, oh, that's okay, it's not going to harden your computer. So now you have this program, this little icon on your desktop that you can click, and everything will run twice as fast. Sorry? Is it for Microsoft? It doesn't say it has to be Microsoft. Well, you probably all know about Superman. He's the Man of Steel, can do just about anything, unless he hits kryptonite. Well, I'll tell you what kryptonite is without even knowing what the super program is. Here's a program which I'm going to call anti-superprog, which has a slot in it where you give me a program which you claim is superprog, and I'm going to slot it in here and say this is my program. Given a program P, I'm going to take this super program, and I'm going to run that program on the program P as if the program P had itself as input. Kind of weird, but you know, why not? Now I'm going to look at the output from superprog, and if that output is the number 0, my program will output the number 1. Otherwise, my program will output the number 0. So, if in fact this superprog is correct, then the output of anti-superprog on the program P is, by construction, different than the output of program P on program P. However, now having done this and checked it out, it's all nicely debugged, I now take anti-superprog and give it to itself. And it guarantees that its output is different than its output. So, this can't be. No one can give you a program superprog to plug in here. Because if it gives any kind of advantage, that advantage will be enough to make up for the fact that you're actually changing the answer at the end, and you'll have a contradiction. So there's no general way to speed up programs so that they're executing fewer instructions without making bigger instructions that do more. So, this super optimization problem of getting the compiler or interpreter to speed up the code is impossibly difficult. Now, this is very similar to the arguments about showing that the halting problem is undecidable. But in fact, the key here is that I stuck in the time and the fact that super prog had to run fast and there was this restriction on time. And so I don't claim that super prog can't exist, but just that it can't speed things up. Of course, I mean every interpreter or compiler is an instance of super prog, except that it doesn't run fast enough. So these are computations that have to take a long time. And in this case, we're saying that in general, to find the output of a program takes as long as actually to just run the program. And sometimes you can shortcut it, but in general, you cannot. So this is a hard problem I'm going to look at. And going to try to model this problem of finding the output of a program as a game. And so the first games I'll be talking about will be artificial. They've been designed just to make this computation into a game. But then I'll talk later about how we get to games that we might actually buy down at the store and actually play. So first, the long computation game. This has two players. I'll call the first the claimant and the second challenger. And the claimant says, I declare that program P on input I outputs 0. And the challenger says, prove it. Why is the result 0? And the claimant says, well, you know, the last thing it did was output register 3, and lo and behold, register 3 had 0 in it. Gosh. Well, why did register 3 have 0? Well, you know, the previous instruction was to subtract register 4 from register 3, and both of 3 and 4 happen to have the value 91. Cool. That produces 3 in register 3. Well, why did register 4 have value 91, I ask. So they just keep going this way, and essentially the claimant is just winding through the computation backwards. Now, that seems a difficult task to do. I mean, it's running a program backwards. How could you have gotten here? Well, let me point out that the challenger also has a difficult task. It was easy at the beginning. You just say, show me. But here, the challenger had to decide that register 4 was the suspicious one. It had to make a decision. The challenger had to decide whether to challenge register 4 or register 3. Or maybe to challenge the fact that it was subtract. Maybe that instruction was actually an add because it was a different place in the program. So both the challenger and the claimant have to know a lot about the computation in order to play this game perfectly. So just to be a little bit more precise, the positions here are basically, well, we have the program and the input as given and fixed. And we have a time during the computation, that is the number of steps that have been executed up to the point under discussion. And then we give the values of the registers and the instruction counter. And also, if we have remote memory that's accessed by the registers, we want to know what are the values in those locations. So for example, if it's a load out of a register, we want to be able to talk about what value comes out. But we don't actually need the entire memory, contents of memory. All we need is those values that are now in the registers. Now, if the value in the registers changes, we'll be talking about a different set of locations in remote memory. But for at a given time, we're only looking at those values that can actually be accessed by the registers. And finally, we have the address and contents of a challenge location, which could be one of these things, the register or instruction counter. It could also be a memory address. And in this case, that memory address could be anything in memory. It need not be the place that currently has a register pointing to it. It's just one that the challenger has said, I don't believe this one. Show me. So this is a position. And the challenger moves, says, either keep the same challenge. Well, you know, you're okay. You haven't shown me you're wrong, but neither have you shown me you're right, so I'll keep the challenge. Or it can decide to challenge another register or location. Or it can, in fact, challenge the instruction counter and say, that's not the instruction that got executed here. And then, faced with this challenge, the claimant gives a position that's going to lead a position that could have been prior. So executing the instruction pointed to by the instruction counter back on the register's values in this new position would actually produce the value that was the position that was challenged, including the challenge location, and says, well, this was the state time before. So it's decrementing the time by one and making whatever changes are necessary and everything else. And so certainly given this new position and the previous position, we can determine that the move is legal, that is that the position given by the claimant would actually produce the challenged position if in fact the new position correctly occurred at its time. And the end of the game happens when the time gets down to zero. And if at the time gets to zero, the position is consistent with actually running that program on that input, and then the claimant wins. Otherwise, the challenger wins. And if zero is, in fact, the correct output, then the claimant can, off on the side, just sort of run the program, see what happens, and then tell the challenger about it. But if, in fact, zero is not the correct output at that time, then the claimant sort of has to fake something. Has to give a position which is not actually the one that would occur. In particular, it must differ in some way from the real position. And so the challenger can always select something in the claimed position which is not correct. And maybe the claimant can walk that one all the way back and keep the charade going until it hits the input. But the input is fixed. The claimant can't change the input or the program, and so it gets found out. So whether the claimant or the challenger can win this game depends on whether or not the output is actually zero. So if we want to determine, given a position in game, who's going to win from this position with perfect play, that's determining what result a computation produces. And we've seen that we can't actually shortcut the process of determining how a computation is going to run. So therefore, we cannot solve this game in general any faster than that. And since, of course, the running time of a program might be exponential in the size of its registers, for example, it might simply just count its register values, then determining who's going to win this game may be exponentially hard in the description of a position. Okay, so that's a game, formally defined, which models the computation. Now, it's not a very satisfactory game, you know. I mean, you know, Mattel is not going to make millions of bucks out of that thing. But it has the property of being a game. So we're at least sort of in the right, well, if not the right ballpark, you know, we're at least somewhere where they play baseball. So the next step here, which I'll go to discuss in much less detail, is that of transforming games, one game into another. And for those of you who have seen the subject, I'll tell you that this is in fact what's called a reduction in complexity theory. So if those of you who may have taken CS341 have seen reductions. And so what I'm talking about here is a reduction in that sense. But for those of you who haven't had that or haven't seen the term reduction before, just think of it as I describe it here and you know, let other people worry about the details. So the basic idea is that of a transformation. We take a game, all of its possible positions, and give a mapping from the positions of that game to positions of another game, such that we're also mapping the move, so that if in game one we make a move from position A to position B, then in game two we have position C and D, which correspond to A and B, and in fact there's a legal move from C to D if and only if there's a legal move from A to B. And in particular, we want that player one wins the position P of G2 if and only if the player one will win the position in the transformed game. So that if we want to talk about strategies for playing the game G1, we can actually think about mapping that over to the game G2 and answering the question there if we know those strategies. So here I have this sort of diagram where we take this computation game, program P on I, and we sort of map it over to this board where it's checkers board or something. So that every program and input in this particular example would be mapped to a set of positions of all the pieces on the checkerboard. Now, to actually go through and do that in a convincing way, I would have to describe for you positions of checkers on a board that would model, say, the value register 3 having value 7. And I'm not going to try to do that. It takes a long time to write down. So I'm not going to try to do that. So I'll just leave it kind of fluffy. But the principle is that you're actually taking all the pieces of a computation here and creating little pieces of game over here that exactly mimic. And you put them together in exactly the right way so that the legal instructions in your program actually correspond to legal moves and checkers. And legal moves and checkers actually correspond to possibilities in the program. And then you end up with the same winner either way. So this notion of transformation of a game then gives you the same kind of transformation of strategies, where we can use one game to solve another. So if we want to discover, is position P a good position for me? That is it a position I want to move to? Then I can look at the transformed position on the other game and then see whether that other position would be good for me. And then the answer is the same. So if we have a good way of solving positions in the game G2, I guess it is, so we have solving just, say, time F, and this transformation from game 1 to game 2 is not too difficult to figure out, say time t, then we're solving the game g1 in time f of t of whatever. So that the time here is we have to transform the current position in g1 to a position in g2, so that's the t here. And then we'll get something which is whose size as a position is at most that, and then we'll apply the function f to that. So if f and t are reasonably small, then we get a reasonably small way to evaluate positions in G1. Or if you turn this around, if in fact there's no good way to evaluate positions in G1, it must be that the transformed positions are also difficult to solve, either because the transformed positions are just the transformed game is very difficult, or because the transformation is difficult. But if the transformation is easy, then and game G1 actually is hard to solve, then game G2 will also be hard to solve. Okay. So as I said, I am not going to try to give the correspondence, say, between the computation game and a game of checkers. Actually, the checkers proof is fairly difficult to do. It's have to get everything exactly right. And actually, it was one of the later examples done. I like to use it because most people think of checkers as being a fairly easy game, you know, that kids play with their grandparents just to keep the grandparents occupied, or maybe the kids or something. But at any rate, I say nothing about the quality of play between kids and grandparents. And we're looking here at determining the exact play of the game on large boards. And in fact, checkers and chess and Go and a variety of other games are actually as hard as this long computation game. So that to solve the checkers position and determine who can win is essentially the same as looking at a program and determining what its output is. Even if that program runs for exponential time in the size of the description of the program and everything else. So it's, again, checkers. To play checkers perfectly on an arbitrary size board requires an amount of time which is exponential in the size of the board. Not simply because there's exponentially many positions to look at, but simply because to compute checkers more quickly would give us a super opt program which can't exist. And the same applies for chess. You can do the transformation. It's a bit arcane, and you've got to decide exactly how many bishops are on the board and all kinds of crazy things like that. But actually, Go, the case of Go is interesting because it's actually one of the easiest cases to do the transformation. The rules of Go are simple enough, and you can set things up such that things are almost forced. You can either do that or that or lose. So you do which one you pick, sort of like which possible challenge you make or something like that. And you can actually lay things out in a fairly understandable way. And I think that Go was in fact the first game to be shown to be in this category of a game that was played without any thought of computation beforehand, and yet was proven to be hard in this sense. Now, that does not say that Go is harder than these. In fact, Go has the same complexity as chess and as checkers. Now, you may say, wait a minute, excuse me. The folks over at Deep Blue had an enormously difficult time getting a chess program, which is good as the best players in the world. But the checkers folks, you know, they just, Alberta, they just knocked off checkers, just poof. And, you know, Go, if you know anything about programs that actually play Go, they are, I'll be nice, they are hopeless at it. Anyone in this room, if you wished, and did not now know the rules of Go, could learn the rules and study the game a bit, and within 6 months, I would guarantee any of you could beat the best program, computer program. Computer programs are just hopeless at Go. The reason, the real reason, is that the Go board is fairly large. Go board is 19 by 19 in its standard size. This is bigger than an 8 by 8 checkerboard. And you use the whole thing, not just half of it. And all the pieces are very simple. They don't move in complicated ways like these chess pieces when the knight goes somewhere you never could quite figure out for the first week you were trying to play the game. The difference in complexity of these is just a scale. Checkers is small enough that we can put enough of it into our database that we can play 8 by 8 accurately. Go is large enough that no matter what kind of database we make, we still have nothing that's of any use to us because we can never get into the database from an arbitrary position. And chess is sort of intermediate. It's a fairly small board, but because you have more pieces that can move in more directions, it's more complex than chess, and then but it's still kind of less than Go. But really, that's just changing the scale. Yeah. Well, I don't know exactly what it will take to make a good Go game. But for example of 1,000, two things to mention there. One is that the computers being run today, the fastest computers today, are probably 1,000 times bigger and faster than the computers that are actually running the best Go programs. And so if you translate that into these, you know, maybe you would get there. But in fact, running on a faster computer doesn't help most of those programs, because they're just the limitation is too big. Also, one way of thinking about exponential is that when you multiply the amount of computation you apply by a certain factor, then that increases the size of the positions you can deal with by a constant factor. So that if you imagine, a 7x7 Go board, which is within reach of the Chinook-like program for checkers, and you could actually get a database that would be useful. But every time you increase by board size by 1, 7 to 8 to 9, then in fact you would have to apply a multiplicative factor to the size of and time of your program. So say you multiply by 1,000, maybe that would give you 7 up to 10. And then you multiply by another 1,000, you got up to 13. And another 1,000, you're up to 16. So eventually, you can have conceive of a computer that's big enough and fast enough to handle 19 by 19 Go. But then people will start playing on 23 by 23, and you're back where you started. So, yes, I mean, these games, as played in practice, are finite games, and so there's a finite answer for any position. And in principle, we could have a big enough computer to handle it. But the rate at which the computation size grows is exponential in the size of growing the board. And the difference between these three games is just where we are on that exponential at the standard size is usually played. Okay, so those games are provably hard. I've sketched for you a proof that determining strategies in checkers or Go or whatever actually would require exponential time in some cases. Sometimes you can say, well, I can just jump every single one of his pieces and right now and be done with the game, but that doesn't happen very often. So these games are very hard. Not too hard to play and enjoy them, but still very, very hard. So let's imagine that we make our computations slightly easier, and we restrict them to say that although we can reference exponential amount of memory, we're not going to use it. We're going to require that the program only reference a polynomial amount of memory, a fairly small amount of memory. And in this case, we can actually incorporate into our positions of the game the entire contents of this memory. It's only polynomial size. Whereas before, everything might have actually been exponentially big and we couldn't fit it down anyway. So let's suppose that the computation is relatively small in the sense of using a relatively small amount of memory. And in that case, we can get a game that I'll call the short computation game. And so a position in the short game actually has a start position and a start configuration and an end configuration for the program. It says that if it's here at a certain time, then it will eventually get to here after a number of steps, which is this integer d, so that if you start here in d steps, you'll get here. And so the claimant wants to prove that this is true, and the challenger wants to say that not. So the claimant move is to specify, well, what position would occur halfway in between? What would be the contents of the registers in the memory halfway in between? And says, here they are. And then the challenger will pick either the first half or the second half and say, no, I don't think you're right there. So this reduces the time that we're considering by a factor of two, and the challenger will choose either the start or the end to get rid of, so then we're back to two positions and ready for another round. The claimant says, this is what's going to happen in the middle, and the challenger will pick one of them to challenge. And, of course, we'll start with start being the initial position for the given program and input, and end is just something that says, I've now output zero. And so the time is simply the exponential time between those, potentially, if it runs for that long. But we're cutting it in half every time. And so when the time gets down to one, then these should be consecutive instructions. We just go and look at the instruction and see whether, in fact, that's a valid step. And if it is valid, the claimant wins. Otherwise, the challenger wins. And the same kind of argument I gave before says that the claimant can win if, in fact, the start and the end correspond to a real computation, whereas if not, then the challenger can win by always picking something that's wrong, and eventually you get to a step that's wrong, and it doesn't match. But the difference here is that we're not going through one step at a time. We're actually cutting the run of the program in half every time, so we're going down by a factor of two. So a computation that would last for 2 to the n moves will actually give us a game that lasts for only n moves. So it's short in that sense. And if you know anything about programming games on a computer, alpha, beta, search, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, then you can see that having only look ahead only n moves is much better than having to look ahead 2 to the n moves. Never mind what value n has. I mean, if n is 3, you know, 3 is a lot better. 3 moves is a lot better than 8 moves. So now we've made an easier game, or at least one that seems easier. It should be easier. But is it still a hard game? Well, we can imagine trying to do the same kind of thing. So this Paul-Mem superop, this program which is only required to work if, in fact, the program actually uses a small amount of memory and never points out to somewhere big and actually accesses that. And we can show that this program actually has to require a long time. And to make the strongest possible statement, we can allow this PolMEM superop to actually use exponential memory itself, as long as it can manage to shortcut all of the programs that actually use polynomial memory. And having done that, then we go through this argument saying that solving the short game quickly gives us a fast implementation of this PolMEM superopt, which wouldn't exist, and so therefore this is a hard game. And this last part is essentially what I've talked about. You do the same thing. But in fact, the second part is unknown. We do not know how to show that programs that actually run in polynomial memory cannot be shortcut. There may be some really clever compiler trick that allows us to execute that program in a fewer instructions than actually running the program would do. So you can get the same output, but you did a different computation in fewer steps. It's conceivable. No one has any idea how to do it. There's no suggestions it should be doable. Nevertheless, we do not have a proof it's impossible. If you actually try to run the proof I did before, what you run into the fact is that you're using too much memory and that your anti-superop actually blows the memory bound. And so you don't get a contradiction. So presumably that's hard. The program itself is still running for exponentially many steps. But because of its restriction on space, we can't quite say you can't shortcut it. So this is a game that seems to be easier than those I've previously talked about, but we can't actually prove it's easier. Now, it is a game that we can transform into other games and get some common games. For example, if we get tired of playing checkers games or go games that last for a long time and invent a rule that says you can't run too long, then, in fact, you get a game which is equivalent to the short game. So, for example, if you prohibit cycles where you're going around for something that's a cycle that doesn't necessarily make progress. Maybe it makes progress, but maybe it doesn't. And so if you prohibit those kind of cycles, so for example in Go, you can prohibit playing a stone on a point from which a stone has been captured, which makes you actually a very different game than Go. But, yeah, it's not very different. It's definitely different. But at any rate, if you put in some kind of stopping rules that says that game can't run for too long, then you get a game which is equivalent to the short game rather than the long game. Some other games in which that sort of happens naturally, for example, this game Hex is one of them. So Hex is played on this sort of grid of hexagons like this, and there's two players, black and white, and so black is trying to place markers in the squares such that there's some path of black marked cells from, say, this side to this side. And white similarly is trying to get from this side to that side. And, of course, if either one succeeds, then the other one cannot. And so that's the end of the game. And since markers are never taken away, this is the number of moves is at most the number of cells, because then you run out. So this is a short game. I guess you can't actually see it in this slide. But if you look real carefully, this particular marker there is done in with dots instead of a full circle to show that the move was just placed there. Now, in fact, in this position, we can tell that the white player has just reached a winning position. And if so, certainly one of these moves by black was a mistake. So here, that's the rules again. If we look at these two cells, then we see that white can guarantee to get one of those. If black takes one, white takes the other. Similarly, for these two cells, if black takes one of these cells, white takes the other one. So white can guarantee that he always plays one of these, and that he always plays one of these, and that will be the path that he wants. So from this position, it's a small position, we can actually see who's going to win, unless he blows it. But when you increase the size of the position, you can get very complicated things, and it can become very difficult to determine. And in fact, this game of hex is equivalent to the short game. Again, the proof here is relatively simple. This was one of the early ones discovered. But of course, it does require fairly large positions in order to lay down this computation and sort of code a register into the positions of these markers. But it is equivalent to the short game. So hex is a game that seems to be very hard to play well, but we don't actually have a proof. Let me mention briefly, I'll be very brief, just these one-player games where only one player is playing and the other one is just checking to make sure they obey the rules. If we look at long one-player games, these turn out to be equivalent to short two-player games. So that's what I just discussed. But if you think about short one-player games, then these appear to be different. And these are games that, again, appear to be very difficult to play perfectly, but there's no proof that they're, in fact, difficult to do so. And in fact, what I've just given you there is a restatement of the problem, does P equal NP? Because, in fact, short one-player games are, in fact, as I've described short, are exactly the games in NP. And so any NP-complete problem will be expressible as a short one-player game. And so here's just three examples. Putting together a jigsaw puzzle is very hard if you're given some nasty jigsaw puzzle where all the pieces will fit with 27 others and you're not sure which is the right one. And maybe you can get a whole section in and say, wait, that doesn't work. I have to redo the whole section because something else doesn't fit over there. Very nasty jigsaw puzzle. But at any rate, if you allow nasty jigsaw puzzles, they're as hard as traveling salesperson. That's it. Thank you.